This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Mitch Tice.
And I'm Bonnie North. Brian Kastner is no stranger to difficult circumstances. The Marquette grad and former Air Force officer received a Bronze Star for his bomb disposal work in Iraq. As a journalist, he received grants to cover the Ebola outbreak in Liberia. And in 2016, Kastner recreated the 1,200-mile canoe journey of the 18th-century Scottish explorer Alexander Mackenzie. Mackenzie was trying to find the Northwest Shipping Passage through the Canadian wilderness to China.
Kastner's newest book, Disappointment River, chronicles both Kastner's own 40-day journey to the Arctic Sea and Mackenzie's much longer trip. Kastner uses Mackenzie's own writings as well as other historical records to set the scene for Mackenzie's journey and to describe his disappointment at not finding the shipping lanes he wanted to.
Brian Kastner was back in Milwaukee recently, just as Disappointment River was published. He stopped by the studio to tell us why Mackenzie's story intrigued him so much that he wanted to recreate that epic journey.
I was in the military. I'm a veteran. And most of my writing up till now, my two books, Long Walk and All the Ways We Kill and Die, are both about Iraq and Afghanistan and the wars there. And all my journalism has been about the wars. And I was always focused on bombs and conflict. And when I was getting ready to take on a new book project, I knew I wanted to write about something different. And so I turned it around and I said, well, what are the books I most like to read? And it's this kind of thing, unexpected history, history that you thought you knew and it turned out that you didn't really understand it. And then also travelogue, going on an adventure. And so I was looking for a project where it was both something that I didn't understand, and I could actually go out and do something about it. That's what I've learned as a journalist and as a writer, is I'm best when I'm going out and finding that story and then bringing it back. And with Alexander Mackenzie, I found him through a Google search accidentally. I happened upon this guy, and I said, I couldn't believe that I didn't already know this. My fourth grade teacher lied to me. You know, Lewis and Clark were not the first Europeans across the continent. It was this other guy I had never heard of, and his expeditions were absolutely epic. And I had a chance to follow along and canoe in his path.
And I didn't know about him either. And I felt the same way as I was reading the book, thinking, wait a minute, my history that I learned when I was in school, it's like we all learned about Lewis and Clark, and maybe it's the lower 48 that they traversed first. But he was up in Canada, into the Northwest Territories, searching for that elusive Northwest Passage.
That's right. And at the time, I should say, I mean, I don't think there's any reason why the Canadians should claim him more than Americans. When he was doing these explorations, it wasn't Canada and it wasn't the United States. It wasn't anything, actually. It was territory that had competing claims. And it was not yet decided what country any of that land would end up in. And in fact, Mackenzie, he first landed in North America in New York City in 1775 in the middle of the American Revolution. And his first posting as a fur trader was in Detroit. So he certainly has plenty of American connections. And then his history is really the history of the continent. Sure, you know, he ended up taking this river that goes through what's now the Northwest Territories, and it hits the Arctic. That's the Mackenzie River. That river basin is the second longest in North America. It's almost like hiding in plain sight. But he was looking for the Northwest Passage, and who knows how history could have been different if people had followed him the way that the Oregon Trail followed Lewis and Clark. That's really why they're famous, is because it was a story of the settlement of the West. And if Alexander Mackenzie had found the Pacific at the end of that river, if he had not found pack ice, then who knows? There could have been a Mackenzie Trail of settlers, and the history of the continent could have turned out way differently.
Yeah, it's interesting because, of course, in the history, you've divided the book up in your own travelogue part, kind of mirroring what was happening with Mackenzie as he was doing his various explorations. And I had forgotten, even though I kind of knew this, I had forgotten how important the fur trade was to the New World. And I put quotes around the New
Right.
World, new to Europe. And the fact that people were making fortunes on exploiting the wildlife and exploiting the people that were already here through the fur trade. And so you've got, you know, the French, you've got the English, Scots in the case of Mackenzie, and then you've got the various tribes, the indigenous people who are already here, who were both either trying to keep people out or throwing their lot in with the Europeans because they saw it as inevitable. And I think you forget, or at least I did, that that was going on at that particular time, that there was this huge economic driver.
Right. I mean, in the 13 colonies, the primary wealth lay in arable land and turning Virginia and Pennsylvania and New York into farms. But once you get north of New York and it's nothing but impenetrable forest and snow, then the primary commodity, the primary wealth lay in furs. And it just so happened that you have all of this forest and all of this snow, which is perfect for, you know, growing things like beaver, that in the snow at the height of winter is when they have the most luxurious furs. And so you have a place where the beaver are plentiful, and it's also the place where there's all these rivers like the St. Lawrence, the Winnipeg, like the Great Lakes, all these bodies of water that cut through the continent. And so they would never have been able to get through all of that land if there were not these rivers. The forest would have been, and the snow and everything else would have stopped them. But you had this confluence of factors where, yes, they could, they being the voyagers, mostly French paddlers with English or American or Scottish bourgeois, they called them, is what the French called them, you know, these agents who did all the buying and selling. And, you know, the indigenous nations there, being able to produce these furs, that's how they got cloth and they got flour and they got weapons and gunpowder and shot and rum and all of these things. It was a mutual economic advantage. And really, it's a story of partnership. I talked to a Canadian historian. I thought this was fascinating. And he said, down south, you guys talk about cowboys and Indians and everybody shooting at each other. And up north, we talk about cowboys with Indians because it was always a partnership. And there were very few white people, and the indigenous nations were really in charge of, you know, it was their economic system, and there was a lot of mutual benefit. Of course, you know, some tribes prospered and some declined, and it was usually who had access to guns and, you know, the spread of smallpox. It's not purely a positive story, but is much more mutual than oppressive.
Although your experience going through these territories and eventually getting to, I guess, is it technically the Pacific you got to, or is it the Arctic?
It is the Arctic. You know, the Rocky Mountains are in the way.
That's so true. Yeah. You kind of have to go north, and then you'd have to swing around Alaska, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, and that is the Northwest Passage now, is around the north slope of Alaska and across, you know, above northern Canada. And that way is open now. But yes, when Mackenzie was on this river, which is now called the Mackenzie River, the Dene people that live up there in the upper basin, they know it as the Detch. Which means big river, and it is. It is absolutely enormous. It's, you know, some places you can't even see the other side, or it takes an hour or two to paddle across. There is this enormous river, and it leaves Great Slave Lake. And Mackenzie had heard from indigenous report trade, you know, with the various people that he traded with, there's this huge river, and it goes west into the setting sun. And he said, ah, we have finally found it. We have found the last little step where we're going to get to the Pacific. And of course, for a little while, it does go west, and then it hits the Rockies and makes that turn, and that's how you end up in the Arctic.
Why did you decide to do this in a canoe?
Well, because he did it in a canoe. And it's the perfect speed to see the country. You know, you're going with the current. When we're paddling, sometimes we're going 5, 7, 10 miles an hour. Our plan was 30 miles a day. So 1,125 miles total from Great Slave Lake to the very last island, Garry Island, which is on the far end of the Delta. It took us 40 days to do it. Some days we did 50 miles. Some days we did zero when we were stuck with the wind. But I think it was the right way to experience it, because not only could I see what he saw, I could see it at the same timeline and the same pace and experience it in a similar way. And I think it would have been vastly different if I had flown into the one or two indigenous communities up there that have an airstrip and just like poked my head out and seen the trees and then got in a plane again. It was a very different experience dealing with the bugs and the lightning and the wind and the where are we going to put our tent tonight? And, you know, it's not a park. There's no designated campsite. So sometimes when you are stuck in a swamp, there's just nowhere to stop. And you really start to appreciate wilderness in a different way.
Yeah, one of the points you make, and I have to say it really kind of set me back a little bit, because I'm guilty of this too, is romanticizing the wilderness.
Right.
And thinking of it as like this Hallmark postcard of the beauty of nature, and we're going to go out and we're animals too, and we're going to, you know, and then you realize, oh my God, I have no interest in living that way.
There's a reason that we developed all the technology that we did. And I blame Thoreau for, for convincing generations of Americans about the importance and the purity and the simplicity of nature. And let me tell you, a microwave and indoor plumbing is simpler. It is not simpler to wonder where you're going to sleep. It's not simpler to wonder where you're going to go to the bathroom. Do I have enough food? Is it going to spoil? Am I going to be struck by lightning because I'm the highest point in, you know, half a mile?
Are the bears going to come?
Are the bears going to come? Keeping away the mosquitoes, am I going to get an infection from, you know, standing in river water and having these bugs eat me all day? That's not simpler. And yes, I think we've really romanticized wilderness. In some ways, it's because in the lower 48, we have killed just about every animal that might eat us. And so we go to these national parks, and all we've done is taken the prettiest places and kind of set them aside. And we forget how much wilderness and boonies and really nothing but trees and rock and bugs there would be between those pretty places. If you had to, you know, if you had to walk from the Grand Canyon to Yosemite, there'd be a whole lot of nothing in between.
Yeah, and you'd be worried about snake bite, and you'd be worried about being eaten alive by bugs or having enough water.
Right, right. You know? And so, you know, that's why I did it in a canoe, to be able to get an appreciation for what was the physical and emotional toll that taking this kind of journey, you know, would have taken on Mackenzie and his voyagers and his indigenous partners, who I should say, Augina, who was also had the name the English chief. That was his Chipewyan trading partner. Augina had never been down this river either. So it was terra nova for all of them. You know, they ran out of food. They fought the bugs. It was very similar.
Do you think it might have been a little more difficult for you because you knew what you were leaving behind? They didn't have microwaves and indoor plumbing much to leave behind.
No, that's true. But at the same time, when they started their trip in June, they were already hungry, because they had wintered over in the interior, you know, up at Fort Chipewyan, which is on what's now Lake Athabasca. So they were already starving. They were already out of flour and root vegetables and fresh meat and everything else. And that's how they started their trip. And I started fat and happy. And when I was done, I mean, I lost 25 pounds paddling for that 40 days, but I put on 35 when I got back. I mean, for a year, I just could do nothing but eat. And so, yeah, I knew what I was missing. But I mean, there are towns along the way. We went 10 days without seeing someone at times, but there's also villages where we could restock on very expensive fresh fruit or, you know, stale bagels and talk to people and get a shower even once in a while. I got two showers on the trip, so that was pretty good. That was a nice break.
What was the first thing you did when you got back to quote-unquote civilization?
I wanted to sleep in a bed. I could go underwater. The river was cold, but, you know, we could get in it once in a while.
And pretty clean from what you wrote.
Yeah, and clean. I mean, there's some marine debris up there, but overall, you know, the indigenous nations up there have really focused on protecting what they have. And overall, they've done a very good job of that. No, I wanted a bed. I wanted to not sleep on rock, and I wanted my back to feel better. Because when I took a shower, all I wanted to do was take a shower again. I was more sad to be done with the shower than actually enjoying it.
When did that change? How long did it take for you to reacclimate into our civilization?
Actually, I think it's pretty easy. I think that it is easy to be a happy, overfed American. There's a reason that we developed this. So I was happy to have those stuff back. You know, as a military veteran, when I got back from Iraq And in Iraq, you know, you're eating chow hall food, which is barely food. And I remember distinctly in the airport on the flight back, there were like 47 kinds of gummy bears for sale in the little kiosk at the airport, and how weird that was. So I guess because I've done this different experience and then back to finger quote normalcy, you know, going back and forth, this time I could look forward to it as opposed to having this odd experience.
Do you think the military background and being deployed and being out where you don't get showers and you don't eat real food for a while and you're in danger, it's a different kind of danger, but you're in a dangerous situation, did that prepare you in any way for this trip?
Yeah, absolutely. I call it misery training. It's learning that when you're cold and wet and tired and hungry, that those things will eventually end. And you just ignore being cold, wet, tired, and hungry, and then, you know, go on and do your business. Yeah, I think that is great training. And when I picked the people to go with me, overall, I had two military buddies that I knew had also received plenty of misery training and, you know, would be good at that. Another friend was from Wisconsin. He lives in Stevens Point. The fourth guy, as it turns out, had never been camping. I didn't know that until we were on the water. And by the end of it, he was a transformed man.
So what do you think for yourself? I mean, the history is fascinating, and the chapters go back and forth between, you know, the 1780s and 2016 when you did this. Putting aside the history for a moment, for yourself, what did you really get out of this? Has the takeaway changed? Does it change as time passes?
Yeah, I think, you know, from a big picture or a big idea, what struck me is that Mackenzie died thinking he was a failure, when in reality he was just 200 years too early. He had this vision that maybe this was the Northwest Passage. And yeah, he wasn't wrong. Like, that is a shipping channel now. There's barges on there. Tuktoyaktuk, this little Inuvialuit village there on the coast. They're talking about putting in a deep water port to service freighters from China. And of course, Mackenzie was trying to get furs to China. So like some of these ideas never go away. So I've thought it's just interesting to think about how, you know, it's not just ideas that are important, but it's also timing that's important. So I guess that's kind of a big picture. For myself, I had never taken a trip like this. A little bit of it was proving to myself that I could do it, despite, like I said, all that misery training in the military. I had not done the Appalachian Trail. I had not spent this many days continuously in the wilderness. And I'm glad I did it and got to experience. I had read a lot about a lot of the challenges in indigenous communities in the North, poverty, desperation, suicide, alcoholism. It was all of that and more. It's actually astounding, you know, the reality of things up there. And I think that's part of the non-romance as well, is seeing the way people really live. And I think that's my strength as a writer, is going somewhere and bringing back a realistic portrayal and portrait. Here is this place that we don't pay that much attention to.
Or even think about it all.
Go there, and this is what it feels like to be a person in that place. And just look at it as realistically as possible. And then write that up the best I can.
If you were able to meet Alexander Mackenzie today, have a pint with him in a pub somewhere, what would you tell him?
I would commiserate with him. I spent like 2 years, 3 years doing nothing but thinking about this man, how he thought about things. I've read every single word of his that survives several times and parsed it out. And I can identify with some of the hardship and privation. I can identify with the fact that it took him years to write the book of this journey. He writes these great letters to his cousin about how he's trying to write, but it's way harder than he thought it would be. And he's having nothing but visions of the dead, and he thinks he's going crazy. And I think every writer can identify, you know, with that a little bit. And so I would just want to listen to him tell stories. I'm not sure that I would want to say much. I think I would want him to, you know, fill in the gaps, you know, in between some of those letters. Tell me more about the crew. We know very little about the voyagers that went with him. I want to hear stories about them. I'd want to hear stories about Augina, who was his Chipewyan partner. We know very little about him.
I wanted to know the stories of the women who went along.
Yes, absolutely. So in this party, Augina brought two wives and the Voyagers brought two of their wives. And this was not some advanced egalitarian thing. It was pure practicality. The men did one job, women did other jobs. And there was, you know, as the Chipewyan said, like, you know, of course you need women. Women can carry twice as much of a load as any man. They can do twice as much work as any man. If the men are going to go out hunting, who's going to do the cooking and who's going to do all of these essential tasks? And we don't even know the names of these women that went. And so I tried to fill in as many gaps as I could, but there's only so much you can do in a nonfiction book.
Well, who knows? Maybe in some other universe, you guys will sit down over a pint and in front of a warm fire, and you'll be able to hear all of those stories. It's just that would be a wonderful conversation, I would think.
I agree.
Well, Brian Kastner, I want to thank you so much for coming in and talking with us about Disappointment River, Finding and Losing the Northwest Passage. What is your next adventure?
I'm not sure I'm allowed to say, but I do have a new project. A new book project, and it's also about the far north, and it's also history, but different. And I have to go on a hike, but it's a shorter hike. So I don't know if that's enough of a tease or too little of a tease.
but I do have some. No canoeing at this.
No. I'll be in the mountains with a backpack instead of in a boat on the water.
Okay. Well, when you're done with that one and you write it up, come back.
Absolutely. I would love to.
It's so great to meet you. Thanks.
Thank you.
Out of the night, into the water, we push the boat from shore.
Brian Kastner is the author of Disappointment River, Finding and Losing the Northwest Passage. The Marquette grad and Iraq War veteran also wrote The Long Walk and All the Ways We Kill and Die. There is more information about him and his work at WUWN.com.
The ore dips into oil like water, and we are away.